The vote kept changing. Mr. Speaker, from a parliamentary perspective, how is that possible?
I think it was the most intimidating moment of my entire life, is standing up in front of a parish hall full of people and coming out to them and answering questions about what it meant to be trans. That was very difficult. By Tuesday afternoon, there were media folks from the local television stations kind of camped out in front of my house, hoping to get a view.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. An international celebration of LGBT rights fights phobias, U.S. House Republicans vote for discrimination, and the transfiguration of an Episcopal transition. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 21st, 2016. The 12th Annual International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia, formerly known by the acronym IDAHO and now IDAHOT, was observed around the world on May 17th. According to the organizing committee, the day is now celebrated in more than 130 countries, including 37 where private consensual adult same-gender sex is a crime. The May 17th date was chosen for the first IDAHO in 2004 to mark the day in 1990 that the World Health Organization removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders. A statement issued ahead of IDAHOT by several human rights bodies called on all governments to follow the World Health Organization's example and depathologize homosexuality. It was co-signed by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, and the Commissioner for Human Rights of the Council of Europe. Bisexual Scottish actor Alan Cumming hosted the UN's first ever LGBTI gala the night before on May 16th. While he praised the world body for observing IDAHOT, he told the Associated Press that it was also kind of ridiculous at the same time that this is the first time anything like this has happened at the UN.
Several hundred people hit the streets of Kosovo, guarded by a heavy police presence, for the second annual Pride Parade, marking the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia in the Balkan state. The marchers included Kosovo's president and deputy foreign minister, and the U.S. and British ambassadors.
Cuban President Raul Castro's straight but not narrow daughter, Mariela, the island nation's most visible LGBT rights advocate, led Havana's largest ever pride parade to mark IDAHOT on May 15th, and then led a similar but smaller observance on May 17th in the Cuban city of Matanzas.
Russian activists risked arrest by holding an IDAHOT flash mob in St. Petersburg on May 17th. More than 40 people from several groups, including Coming Out and the Side-by-Side LGBT Film Festival, gathered at the unauthorized demonstration. If police had arrived before the flash mob dispersed, the participants could have been detained for violating Russia's infamous no-promo-homo law.
The largest ever LGBT rights event was held in Uganda on the same day. Thanks to both government and religious leaders, with a major assist from frequently visiting U.S. evangelical cure peddlers, overwhelming bias against sexual and gender minorities is woven into Uganda's national culture. Mindful of the possible consequences of attempting a pride march down the streets of Kampala, organizers instead put together an IDAHOT observance along the shores of nearby Lake Victoria. The day included food and drink, performances on a rainbow-bedecked stage, and beach games. Happily, authorities let the unauthorized event go on, and there were no disruptions or arrests.
But 10 activists were arrested at the break of dawn on May 17th in the former Soviet nation of Georgia for spray painting "All Love is Equal" on the fence of the Georgian Orthodox Patriarch's office. The church has been a strident opponent of LGBT rights. Police said the activists are facing charges ranging from vandalism to disobeying police orders, but there were no reported injuries.
In other news, Bolivia's Chamber of Deputies passed legislation on May 19th that would allow trans people to change their gender and name on official documents. The South American nation's Deputy Justice Minister, Diego Jimenez, strongly supports the measure, noting that Bolivia's constitution prohibits all forms of discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation. The gender identity bill still needs Senate approval and the signature of President Evo Morales. If Morales eventually signs the bill, trans people will nonetheless be required to first apply to the Ministry of Justice for an ill-defined psychological examination of some sort before they can legally change their identity.
Denmark's government is running out of patience with the World Health Organization regarding its continued classification of transgender people as mentally ill. Gender identity disorder, the medical term used to define transgender people, is currently listed as a mental condition in the WHO's International Classification of Diseases. Even though the global medical body removed homosexuality from that list in 1990, WHO officials say only that they're continuing to assess the situation regarding trans people. Denmark is a longtime leader in its progressive treatment of transgender citizens. Health Minister Sophie Lode told reporters this week that her government intends to declassify transgender people as mentally ill by itself early next year if the World Health Organization hasn't made the change by then.
Lesbians in Portugal will soon have access to artificial insemination and other fertility services. Until now, those services have only been available to married heterosexual couples who've lived together for more than 2 years. The Associated Press reports that lawmakers in the European nation also approved changes to relevant laws involving surrogacy, giving lesbians that option, but only if the woman has health problems preventing pregnancy. Portuguese lawmakers opened civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in 2010. The latest changes are due to take effect within the next few weeks. Left-of-center parties gained a parliamentary majority in elections at the end of last year. The same majority also recently passed legislation removing some restrictions on abortion and allowing same-gender couples to adopt children.
A group of 51 Muslim countries blocked several LGBT organizations from attending an important HIV/AIDS conference at the United Nations scheduled for next month. Egypt wrote to the president of the General Assembly on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, objecting to the participation of those groups. According to a Reuters report, the letter gave no specific reason for the objections, but the Islamic group's anti-LGBT positions are well documented. Earlier this year, it joined the 54-member African group and the 25-member Group of Friends of the Family that includes Belarus, Egypt, and Qatar to protest the UN's 6 new postage stamps promoting LGBT equality. UN ambassadors from the US, the EU, Canada, and Australia all slammed the decision. Critics say that it will prevent activist groups that include African Men for Sexual Health and Rights, Ishtar Men Who Have Sex with Men, and the Asia-Pacific Transgender Network from attending. Pink News reported that queer-friendly NGOs from Egypt, Thailand, Kenya, Guyana, Jamaica, Peru, and Ukraine have also been banned. According to the Associated Press, at least one U.S.-based group, Global Action for Trans Equality, is also not welcome to what is being billed as a major gathering aimed at formulating new ways to fight the worldwide pandemic. It's scheduled for June 8th and 9th at the UN headquarters in New York City.
In other news, police in Bangladesh have arrested an Islamic militant for the brutal murders of two LGBT rights activists. Jul Hasmanan, who edited the country's only LGBT publication, and Mahbub Tunoy, a college student and fellow activist, were found shot and slashed to death in an apartment in Dhaka in April. Police said this week that 37-year-old suspect Shariful Islam Sihab is a member of the Ansarullah Bangla team, which has been blamed for the murders of academics as well as religious and sexual minorities. Several members of the same group were convicted last year for killing an atheist blogger. Sihab reportedly admitted supplying one of the two guns used in the murders, but denied being one of the 6 men who are believed to have been involved in the bloody assassinations.
In happier news, the United States has its first openly gay Secretary of the Army. Eric Fanning was already the highest-ranking out member of the Department of Defense. After months of delay by one obstructionist senator who finally relented, a single member can block a presidential nomination for any reason under the archaic rules of the chamber. The U.S. Senate confirmed Fanning in a unanimous voice vote on May 17th. President Obama submitted Fanning's nomination last September. But until this week, Republican Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas had placed a hold on the nomination in a totally unrelated dispute over Obama administration plans to close the facility at Guantanamo Bay and transfer dangerous terrorists to maximum security prisons in the U.S. No one, not even Roberts, questioned Fanning's credentials. He's held jobs with several branches of the U.S. military for the past several years. He served as Air Force Undersecretary and Deputy Chief Management Officer and Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy. The 47-year-old Fanning most recently served as Acting Undersecretary of the Army. He's been a close civilian advisor to Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who said he was proud to swear Fanning in soon after the vote.
And finally, President Barack Obama is reportedly soon to declare the first ever U.S. national monument recognizing the struggle for LGBT rights. The Stonewall Inn, in the heart of New York City's Greenwich Village, was considered a dive bar in June 1969. Two nights of rock-throwing rebellion against a routine police raid late that month sparked America's modern queer liberation movement. City officials are apparently still investigating the history of the land title. But barring any last-minute complications, President Obama is expected to declare the Stonewall Inn and its nearby surroundings a national monument and part of the National Park Service, just in time for next month's traditional U.S. LGBT Pride celebrations.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 21st, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
In a late-breaking News Wrap update, Bolivia's gender identity bill was unexpectedly approved in quick order by the Senate and signed into law by Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera on May 21st. President Evo Morales was on state business in Havana at the time. The new law allowing trans people to change their name and gender on official government documents is one of the most progressive trans-related laws in the region.
I couldn't stand to see people that I love go through this.
Crucified in the press and buried in the pulpit, a trans priest rises again later in the program. It was Robert's Rules of Chaos in the U.S. House of Representatives on May 19th when the right to discriminate against people on the basis of religious beliefs came to the floor. Out Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney of New York offered an amendment to strike a stipulation from a major defense spending bill that grants that right to religious corporations, associations, and institutions that receive federal contracts.
This bill writes anti-gay bias into federal law. It strips LGBT Americans of basic workplace protections by reversing the president's anti-discrimination orders, saying it is once again legal for your LGBT neighbors and family members to be fired because of who they are. This is wrong. This is not about supporting our troops. It's not about fighting ISIS. It's not about religious protections. We can do all that, and we should. This is about bigotry, plain and simple. When my husband and I got married after waiting 22 years, so many of you expressed your support. Will you now look me in the eye and say it would be okay for me to lose my job over it?
Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle reports on what happened soon thereafter.
On this vote, the ayes are 212, the nays are 213. The amendment is not adopted.
Shouts of shame, shame, shame erupted in the House of Representatives as Republican lawmakers narrowly defeated legislation to protect the civil rights of LGBT employees of government contractors. According to the count in the House chamber, the measure, an amendment to a Veterans and Military Construction spending bill, initially had enough yes votes to pass, but ultimately it failed by one vote. House Republican leaders extended the time allowed for the vote as they urged enough party members to change their positions to defeat it by a vote of 213 to 212.
Mr. Speaker,
House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer of Maryland.
I want to raise a parliamentary inquiry initially with reference to the fact that Mr. Ryan, our Speaker, has told us if people were in the well, that the vote would be held open. I was standing in the well. No one came, or no one had the courage to come into the well to change their vote. But notwithstanding that, the vote kept changing. Mr. Speaker, from a parliamentary perspective, how is that possible?
The chair was entertaining requests for changes.
I saw no one come to the desk to change their vote, Mr. Speaker.
Does the gentleman have a parliamentary inquiry?
The parliamentary inquiry is, how can the vote change when no one comes to the well to change their vote?
The chair had not yet announced the request for changes.
I didn't hear the chair request change, but I do know that from my own personal observation, not one of those members who apparently changed their vote because it kept changing on the board came to this well and had the courage to change from green to red or red to green. How is that possible, Mr. Speaker?
Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, said in a statement, House Republicans are so committed to discriminating against LGBT Americans that they broke regular order to force their members to reverse their votes and support Republicans' bigotry. Republicans who backed the provision said it was necessary to protect the religious rights of military contractors and not intended to be discriminatory.
In early voting, Maloney's amendment was ahead by 6 votes, so 7 Republicans had to have changed their votes for the final one-vote loss. According to a May 20th story in Capitol Hill's newspaper of record Roll Call, not just 7, but closer to 30 Republicans actually changed their votes on anti-LGBT bias. Only 29 GOP members voted for the Maloney amendment this week. 60 Republicans voted last year for a similar amendment upholding President Obama's ban on federal contractors practicing employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Back then, before he assumed the typical non-voting role of House Speaker, Paul Ryan voted for the LGBT protections.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
An informed community is a strong community.
Fayetteville and some of the other cities have passed ordinances, and it shows that there is some progress in moving towards justice for all people.
We first met transgender activist Reverend Gwen Fry in April talking Arkansas politics, politics that becomes personal in this follow-up conversation with our Abby Dees.
2 years ago, Episcopal priest Gwen Fry came out publicly as a trans woman. And despite genuine support from within her church, a firestorm erupted beyond her imagining. The Reverend Gwen Fry had been the priest in charge for a year at Grace Episcopal Church in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, when everything changed.
Before I came out, I heard time and time again I was the best priest they ever had in the last 25 years. The day I came out and the day afterwards, I was a monster.
In 2012, gender identity and gender expression officially became part of the Episcopal Church's non-discrimination canon. This was the moment Gwen decided that she would start the journey to come out to her church and community. In February 2014, Gwen told her bishop and the vestry. She felt supported and encouraged by everyone. Well, almost.
There was one individual who, when I came out at the vestryman meeting, just turned to me and asked me, well, does this mean that you're going to be wearing curlers in your hair and have eyeshadow in the pulpit?
because no woman would wear curlers in her hair in the pulpit. Well, that's a stupid question.
Exactly. But that was just kind of where they were coming from.
The bishop counseled a careful step-by-step approach to coming out to the whole parish, hoping to create time for reflection. And that was the plan, briefly. But word immediately leaked out, and that was it for baby steps.
So what the vestry asked me to do is to basically tell the entire parish at a special coffee hour on that next Sunday. And so that Sunday rolled around, and our average Sunday attendance was about 50. That Sunday, there were 90 in the pews. And with everything that was going on, I think it was the most intimidating moment of my entire life, is standing up in front of a parish hall full of people and coming out to them and answering questions about what it meant to be trans. That was difficult. That was very difficult.
After you did that, you said you got a lot of positive response from the parish. What form did that take?
Them talking to folks who were upset or concerned, not necessarily upset, their support of me and my family to see how we were doing, emails, telephone calls. They were really, really working hard to stay out in front of this momentum that was building. Unfortunately, even with their help, that never happened. The Monday morning after I came out to the parish, the local newspaper was calling the diocesan office and me for interviews and statements. Tuesday morning, it made the front page of the local paper. By Tuesday afternoon, there were media folks from the local television stations kind of camped out in front of my house, hoping to get a view. It was very, very difficult because my spouse was also a priest in a different parish. And at that point in time, we were concerned that she too would be losing her position over that. By Wednesday morning, I just saw that there was no way that I could get out in front of it. The parish was splitting up over this and breaking up. It was even into some of the families where spouses were kind of divided on this and children against their parents. And I couldn't stand to see people that I love go through this. And so I called the bishop on that Wednesday morning and I told him that he put me in the position and, you know, he had the ability and the authority to get me out. And so he did that. There was a special vestry meeting that Wednesday evening. He wrote a letter to the senior warden of the vestry and the vestry, which basically dissolved the pastoral relationship between myself and the parish. And that was the last time I walked out of that church building.
Did you feel at all supported by the diocese or people in positions of authority?
The bishop was extremely supportive. Perhaps not in a public way, but certainly quietly behind the scenes. For that, I am very grateful. Once this broke and once the blogosphere started picking up and running with this story, my trans friends, both within the Episcopal Church and in the general public, were very, very helpful and supportive of me and my family. If Facebook is an indicator, the couple of days after I lost my position, you know, there were folks from all around the world who were sending friend requests and things like that because they had heard what had happened. And that was quite powerful for me to see that I had that kind of support, not only locally and nationally, but with folks from around the world. That was nice.
I just want to be absolutely clear that I understand. It seems to me like you saw kind of an eruption. Did you initiate the idea that you had to leave, or was that going to happen anyway?
It was going to happen anyway. It had just gotten beyond anyone's control and took on a life of its own. I've painted the congregation in a negative light, and I don't want to do that. I chose to come out there and transition there because I truly did feel like there was a chance of having success and staying in that position because they are quite progressive. It was just different with their priest.
Yeah. Did this do anything to your faith?
No.
Did your faith get you through this?
It most certainly did. Anyone who's been active in a religious tradition, especially clergy, knows that you cannot put your faith in the institution. You have to put your faith in God. I did that. It was very, very difficult those first few days. But after I lost my position, as a matter of fact, the day after that, a friend of mine from another local parish who did not know what had happened the evening before just invited me to a church service. It was a 6 o'clock service in the evening, very accepting liturgy and group of people. I knew that I needed to go to church and reconnect with God. So I did, and late that afternoon I got dressed and I walked out of the house for the first time as Gwen to go to church. As if that wasn't powerful enough, when I got there and they read the gospel, it was the gospel reading of the Transfiguration, the last Sunday of the Epiphany, and it was like, oh my God. It was an overwhelming experience, and I was accepted by the folks there in that congregation, and so I've been there ever since.
This happened in, well, about just over 2 years ago. How did you survive? How did you get through?
The thing that got me through, to be really honest with you, were the friends that I had in Trans Episcopal, which is a transgender group within the Episcopal Church. And also, I didn't sleep a whole lot. But the thing that really helped me was I could sign into Facebook, and there was always a friend online that I could talk to 24 hours a day. That was truly life-saving. So I will never, ever speak badly about social media, because it quite honestly saved my life.
You've talked extensively about the idea that you must love your enemy. How do you do that when there's an organized, impassioned vitriol being hurled at you and your community every day?
One of the things I hold on to is what Jesus said on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I truly do carry that with me wherever I go, and that in and of itself gets me through a whole heck of a lot.
There are welcoming Episcopalian dioceses in other places. Why did you stay?
At this point, I feel a real calling to have a ministry here. Really, over the past year, year and a half, I've been more and more involved in advocacy and activism here in the state. I have gotten involved in a number of organizations like Arkansas Transgender Equality Coalition, which is a trans organization that encompasses the entire state, working for trans folks. I'm also involved in Pride Corps here in Little Rock, which is a youth center for LGBT folks and their teens and young adulthood. I have found that I am called to be here because there is so much work to do here, and we're beginning to see the tide kind of change, and there's some energy and movement in the right direction here, and I want to be a part of that.
This is Abby Dees, and I've been talking with the Reverend Gwen Fry about her experience coming out trans in the pulpit. Is that a good way of saying it?
Perfect.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Sarah Sweeney, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with double thanks to Steve Pride and to Mark Miracle of Pacifica Radio News. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations like WMPG in Portland, Maine, and to you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on GaySA Radio, Pretoria, South Africa, WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.